Hello, everybody. This is Shane Jensen, professor of statistics and data science here at the Wharton School. On this week's Wharton Moneyball Highlights, we talk with Micah McCurdy, who, to get us hyped about the upcoming NHL playoffs. We have a really interesting discussion about the distribution of talent in hockey and other sports. Micah can be found on Twitter at ineffectivemath. Enjoy the discussion.
From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to a full hour of sports analytics here on SiriusXM. This is Cade Massey hosting this week with my longtime friends and collaborators, Shane Jensen and Audie Weiner. Our fourth co-host, Eric Bradlow, is out this week doing Eric Bradlow things. I think he's going to be doing Eric Bradlow things again next week. So we got a couple of weeks without Eric, but the rest of us will be here. Some combination of us are here every week, almost every week of the year, have been for 10 years now, pushing into our 11th year, having just celebrated our 10th anniversary a couple of weeks ago. We are recording on Tuesday afternoon, as we typically do. The show will go up on SiriusXM early tomorrow, be replayed a few times over the course of the week. We'll get the podcast up tomorrow as well. We love to hear from you guys. If you're listening and have a comment, a reaction, a suggestion, a criticism, love of Shane Jensen's attire, whatever you got, hit us up on Twitter at WMoneyball. At WMoneyball is the best way to reach us for whatever interesting observations or claims or suggestions you have. We have Micah McCurdy joining us. Micah, frequent guest of the show. When we need to talk hockey, we generally think of Micah. Micah is posted up way in the Northeast, way up there, Halifax. He's the only person we talk to from Nova Scotia, and we're delighted to do that. Micah is a math nerd in the most formal sense. He has a master's from Cambridge. He has a PhD in math. You can find him on Twitter. His handle is even math related. His handle on Twitter, @ineffectivemath. Micah is a serious analyst, but something that distinguishes him as an analyst beyond his topic of hockey is his interest in data visualization. He goes to greater lengths and to, I would say, artier links than maybe any other analyst that we have on the show, but he always makes them effective. So he's a terrifically interesting follow. Micah, good to have you. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you.
Micah, how are things in Halifax? It seems it's kind of a bad time of year to be in Philadelphia. I can't imagine that it's a good time to be in Halifax. Or is it that you're so close to the ocean that spring comes a little early? Is it messy, gray, nasty? What is it?
The weather is always bad. There are lots of great reasons to live here, and I would never live anywhere else. And the weather just isn't one of the reasons. It's effectively in the ocean. You can consider it as being rainy or slushy many, many months of the year. Okay. Right now it's raining.
No different than the rest of the year. So it's not especially bad time. Got it. That's helpful. That makes sense. So what are you doing with yourself? Before we drop into like details, which were interesting to chew on with you, can you give us an update on the NHL in general? We neglect the NHL a little bit. You know, we come off football, we roll right into basketball. We have a hard time not talking about baseball. But we all love hockey, and we know it's about to hit the postseason. We'll start paying more attention. But before we do that, can you give us a little bit of a rundown on what we've seen through the regular season? We know our Flyers kind of unexpectedly probably land a playoff spot. Other than that, what should we be knowing about the NHL as we start paying it more attention?
Well, you mentioned the Flyers kind of walking backwards into a playoff spot that they sure didn't expect at the start of the season. And that's one of the big storylines, is how the Eastern Conference specifically is a real turtle race. There's an unusual weakness in the sort of middle of the crowd there. There's always sort of a gap somewhere in the standings where there's, you know, a real distinction between the good teams and the bad teams. Yeah. And when that gap is, you know, between 8 and 9, that's where everybody would love it to be. That's great. And unfortunately, this year in the East, it's kind of between 5 and 6, where you got that big, big space. And so there's 4, maybe 5 good teams, and then there's another 5 or 6, and a few of them are going to get playoff spots, even though they're not particularly good. And hockey being what it is, one or two of them might catch lightning in a bottle and win a playoff round or two, and then everybody's going to be talking about it.
Guys, one way I was thinking about this in the hour before the show, I don't think we've talked about it this way. If you consider the relation between, let's say, power rankings among the playoff teams and winning a championship, So imagine running just a simple logistic regression where you're asking how well the power rankings in the beginning of the playoffs predicts who wins the championship. How much weaker is that model going to be for NHL than for the other four sports, other three major North American sports?
I would jump in and say that I don't know the answer, but it's got to be a lot weaker.
First of all, relative to basketball, which is the most similar in terms of structure, I mean, it's almost identical in terms of structure. It's much less than basketball, right? I mean, you know, I guess you could kind of think about it in a March Madness sense, like what's the, you know, what are the kind of some of the seeds that you get in the final rounds or whatever. You often have an 8 beating a 1 in hockey. We saw, you know, the Boston Bruins have an unprecedented season last year, you know, regular season wise, and just, you know, they were a 1 that lost to an 8 in the first round of the playoffs. It was remarkable. So that type of thing. And I mean, I think that type of thing is certainly much less often in basketball. In baseball, I feel like the playoffs are pretty random, but you're cutting a lot more, like you're cutting, you know, you're only taking really the best teams in baseball for the playoffs. Yeah. It's a little bit different, less dynamic.
Okay. I wonder what Michael would say. He has some free analytics up, and he has some subscription analytics up, and I'm sure he's got a power rating among the subscription guys. Let's take up another one of Micah's suggested questions. You know, when you talk about age curves, this is a good thing for you statisticians. How much do they get thrown off by, you know, rare but super visible players with extraordinary longevity, like, you know, Brady in the NFL, for example? And how do we handle that? And then he said, could that happen at the bottom as well? Do we get messed up in our modeling by some extreme events? How do y'all think about that when you think about age curves? Pick your favorite sport and talk about how you deal with the tails, essentially.
Well, I'm going to leave Shane to answer that in more detail. I can tell you it's a bear of a problem because you have that selection bias issue. And that survival bias as well. I mean, everything we do, we typically do post fact, right? So we look post hoc, we look at what we've seen, and the upper echelons of age are necessarily people who've had great careers. And it's a very hard anticipate. We call that anticipating problem. So you've already seen something. So that information works its way into the model in very difficult ways. And it's very hard to build a completely unanticipating, or what you might call unspoiled model that doesn't have what we call data bleed, where that information about the future is sort of built into the modeling, even when you try to do it by holding out. It's very tough to do. We don't have an experiment. We don't get to watch people play, and where their decision to play is independent of their performance, and then get to watch their age curves appropriately and average. It's just not possible. So it's
What are the consequences? What do we get wrong as a result of this anticipatory / bleeding problem?
I would guess that we don't get the full extent of the curve. We miss the high derivative elements. I think things just get kind of melded out.
Howdy, high derivative elements.
So rapid changes. We don't see that.
Rapid drops off.
Anything rapid.
To the extent that we're not able to completely correct for that selections, that survivorship bias, we tend to over kind of emphasize, or like, you know, like tend to overestimate, you know, future success as people age, and specifically those kind of big drop offs that you occasionally see in due to injury or something like that. I think we have a really hard time doing, because it's, you know, really kind of a very small sample to try and be looking at. So, you know, kind of cutting the data up by injury and age and all these other things.
It's interesting that you mentioned this point about injury specifically, because injury is so frequently the mechanism of retirement. Unfortunate as that is, and so that causes problems with the way that people leave leagues, but it doesn't cause the same issues on the other end of the curve. So on the other end of the curve, you have this gatekeeping problem. You know, if you're a veteran and you want to play and you say you're good, you're probably going to get minutes until you're very, very not able to do it. Whereas the same is not true if you're 19, 20 years old. You might be that good, and yet you still have to break through the expectations of the people who make decisions about whether or not you can play. And so from a modeling perspective, on the one hand, you know, you look at injuries and you think, oh, we're going to try to estimate the probability that somebody has a career-ending injury. You know, that's just a fool's errand. But on the other hand, if you want to say, well, am I going to try to put in how much this coach trusts young players as a first order element in my model? You know, maybe you have to in order to properly model who is and who is getting observed in the league.
Certainly with that's interesting, like, because I guess you would have, you know, that's the type of thing where in hockey, at least, in baseball, you often can kind of get like development windows are kind of longer. You can kind of get these players that say blocked by already ensconced athlete at a particular position. I don't know. Do you get that as much in hockey where, because you can kind of have, you have multiple shifts of defensemen, you don't have like defensemen blocking younger development of talent in the same way, do you?
Not as much. And of course you also have the waiver system in hockey where, you know, you can only keep rosters that are so big. And so if you have all these extra people, then eventually you got to put them on waivers if you don't want to keep them on your roster. And so that amounts to another pressure that keeps younger, decent players in the league a little bit more than they might otherwise. You know, they don't have the same individual team control that baseball does, where you can hold on to a larger roster and more precisely control exactly where all of your players are. But you can still run into problems where you have to still, there's a barrier there to break through all the same, where you've got to get yourself noticed. And so that, I think, goes back to what you were saying a moment ago about higher derivative elements, about where you need to show a rapid change in order to get through a static approach, which can be common in conservative sports, and hockey is one of the more conservative sports.
From a modeling perspective, could you get any traction just modeling that process, even just without any real knowledge, but just probabilistically saying with some probability, we're not going to observe this guy despite his talent because of some gatekeeping operation? Would that help you avoid misrepresenting the actual distribution of talent in some way?
I think so. I'm actually grappling with this right now. It's sort of easier said than done, but even, you know, modeling specific agency of saying, you know, this coach, these are his tendencies, you know, that I think is never going to be, or perhaps not soon going to be plausible. But something along the lines of saying, you know, this is like a logistic function or some other kind of like something that goes from 0 to 1 with a bend in the middle, where you can say, well, and where do you put the bend and how steep is it? Well, you can kind of approximate that for the whole league and say, well, on average, if you are this good, you will, you know, this is where you're a 50-50 chance to be in the league. And if you're this much better, then you're 80% chance. You know, you could probably make something sensible along those lines. But then when you do that, and this is before you even get into aging, which has its own specific details there, but even just imposing that kind of condition already makes your distribution of talent asymmetric.
Oh, for sure.
Which is important. I mean, it's not that it's not a mistake by any means. It just means that a lot of the tools that you might be habitually used to using are going to be based on symmetric assumptions. Like here, we know that this thing is around here, but we don't know what side it's on. But when it comes to talent in a league that's at the top of a system, you know, where the NHL is the de facto top hockey league, you should expect that the sides of the distribution are not going to be the same, that it's going to be much, much squarer on the bottom because of exactly that gatekeeping operation where it's the job of many people to say you're good enough and you're not. Mm-hmm. But at the top of the distribution, there's no pressure like that whatsoever. You're twice as good as the last guy we've ever seen. Great. We'll just enjoy the goals.
Let me ask a related question from the NFL. And we observe a somewhat similar problem. If you just want to model, and Adi, I want you to jump in here on one of this in a minute, but if you just want to model the distribution of talent, of just the sheer underlying quality of a player, we just, in some cases, we'd like to know how to represent that. In fact, a lot of cases, if we had a formal distribution, a family of distributions we could use, it would give us a lot of traction because we don't have that much data. And if we had a formal distribution, then we could borrow a lot of strength from those distributions. But we have some problems. First, we don't observe the left tail. There's a, you have to be a minimum quality to show up in the league. So this is left sensor data, because there's a minimum, there's a salary, there's a roster limit, and there's a minimum salary. And so of all the guys drafted, for example, all the guys that ever try out on an NFL team, your practice squad or whatever, there's a long left tail that we never observe in the NFL because they're cut, they're censored, and we don't know what the shape of that thing is. We just have to kind of guess at it. This is a long, but this is a long setup for saying, and this comes right back at you, Micah, and this was a surprising observation to us. We dug into this a little bit, some folks that I've done some work recently with, and our best estimate is that it actually is a symmetrical distribution. It surprised me. It's a censored symmetrical distribution, but the underlying distribution of talent, is that even possible? I mean, is it kind of, it seems implausible that among guys who walk on the NFL practice fields, that the talent's kind of normally distributed, or is it? And I think it requires a super noisy selection process. I think it requires that the guys who are drafting or assigning undrafted free agents, they have an imperfect signal of how good that player is. And if you could actually observe true talent for the full distribution, it would be pretty symmetrical.
That's so what, I think in very broad terms, in you know, like the broadest sort of like, are humans good at a thing? How does the goodness of the thing look? I think you should always expect, if you take a broad enough population, that you should expect something roughly symmetric.
Right.
In just, you know, at the highest level of generality that you want. And then, but after that, you are expecting, in a very general way, again, you're expecting that the people making decisions are corporately, if not individually, still doing it reasonably well.
Yeah.
And that's what should create that skew that we expect in top leagues. In fact, you should see it not just in top leagues, you should see it in the next leagues down.
You would expect the left tail that thinned out, because era will be randomly distributed. Some era is going to be worse than other era, but there's no reason to expect that left tail to be distributed the same way as the right tail, because the right tail is going to be the extreme talent, extreme positive talent distribution. And there's no reason to expect that should be distributed the same way that era. So I'm talking my way into away from the symmetric, but
the thing is, Cade, the underlying talent parameter might have more of a symmetry to it, but when it's applied to produce statistics on the field, that's going to be stretched out on the right tail. So you think about what that means. So you have some underlying theta. I don't know what you want to call it. We usually use theta for a parameter. And then if we plug that into some function, if you're high on you're like the best theta out there, that's going to get stretched in terms of your statistic on the court. Well, that's because of the way the games are played, right? Because if you think about it, I'm better than everyone. I'm the extreme value. I'm going to just clean up, right?
And that gives more opportunities.
I'm going to win much more often. Think about the greatest players in history. Is it because of their underlying theta, if you will, was 7, 8, 9, 10 standard deviations? Think about Babe Ruth when he hit 10 standard deviations more home runs than the average in that year. I don't think he was a 10 standard deviation underlying parameter. He just was doing something so different from everybody else that he got stretched out.
Baseball seemed like a bad example for that to me, because I was sitting here thinking, well, that wouldn't be the case if everyone got the same number of opportunities. So, for example, you know, throwing darts, the dart performance is going to look a lot like the underlying talent.
Yep.
With noise, of course, a little noise on top of it. But if basketball shooting is not that. Everyone doesn't get the same number of shots. And so I could see the game of basketball stretching that theta out like you talked about. But I don't see that for baseball. Why would that happen in baseball?
Well, you typically shouldn't. But someone like Babe Ruth, it happens with, because he was so crazily different from him. He was trying to do something no one else was doing. And he was trying to hit home runs no one else was bothering. So you end up with this crazy stretch out.
We changed the game personally. Okay.
Personally changed the game. I mean, and that created that crazy tail. Let's take us back to hockey. Like someone like Wayne Gretzky, what his underlying theta, his records are bizarre in terms of standard deviations from even other stars. It's just nuts how far an outlier is he. Is it because of this underlying true talent thing? Is that far out? Or is it a combination of the way it gets transformed into statistics on the in the field of play?
Mm-hmm. That transformation, that stretching that you call it, is another form of survivor bias, and where it's not just that people of this quality are permitted into the league and people of this quality are not, but also within every season, every single performance is being judged on the field. And so even minor deviations in the scale of things can lead to players being benched, put down the lineup, cut. Whereas a deviation that's positive is going to be rewarded. And coaches are going to say, is it lucky? Absolutely, it's lucky. And I'm going to enjoy the benefits for as long as it lasts. And I'll change my strategy when I have to and not a moment before. And whereas you can't, you know, you can take that opinion if you like about the deviations that are negative, the sort of luck-based fluctuations inside a natural talent. But you have to have the horses to be able to wear that, both in terms of the media and in terms of the win-loss record in the day-to-day until it goes away. And so what makes the variation from sport to sport really interesting is that not all sports have the same natural timescales for those variations. And so you can be, as a team in the NHL, you can have above average shooting luck for most of your guys for most of the season. And that is sort of an uncomfortable truth, but you can. And so you might as well just ride that. And so you're going to, you know, or any other form of luck can last for longer than might be comfortable when it comes
I always think about that specifically in hockey, being the hot streak of a goaltender. You know, it basically, it can ride you all the way through a playoff run.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable because, you know, it's kind of you're riding something you're not necessarily sure is real. Like maybe your goaltender isn't even necessarily a theta in that right tail, but for an entire playoff run, they can be.
No, but are you saying that this is something that's a momentum-like attribute, or is it just the luck of it? And that, so in other words, it's decided by the luck of it. You're riding your Lily's good luck, not really riding it. You just got there on the back of it, and that's why you won.
Riding suggests that it's predictable, yeah. And that's the part that Adi and I are kind of blanching at. It's not really predictable, right? You're ex post riding it.
Yes, you ex post wrote it. That's right.
Yeah, the uncomfortable part is you're not sure if you're on one of those streaks that is going to last or not. I agree with Mike's sort of time scale perspective. When you can have sort of like unusual performance over the course of most of a season, that does, you know, I think, you know, affect sort of how you model performance and how you price it.
Imagine you're a hockey team with two goalies. You have your starter and your backup, and they're pretty close in quality, but the starter's the better. Historically, has been better. And for whatever reason, your starter's down. The backup's been playing halfway through the playoffs and has been on that run that we talk about. And then the starter is ready to come back. Shane, what do?
You ride that hockey.
You ride it. That is a hockey fan talking.
And yeah, I mean, I do hope we get Micah's perspective on it as somebody who's probably a little bit, bring a more numerate perspective. But yeah, you ride that hot goaltender.
And I know that Eric Bradlow rides the hot goaltender, but what does Kate Massey do? Because I don't.
But I think,
I don't know what I'm talking about.
Michael will probably jump in, but like, I think it all, that's a statement in part about momentum or whatever nebulous concept we're talking about. But we're also talking about kind of the talent distribution in hockey goaltending, in my opinion. There are a few goaltenders that are kind of, you know, the Mariano Rivera or something like that of goaltenders, where they are predictably good, where you'd probably want to put them in no matter what, even if you had the hottest possible streaky, you know, kind of average goaltender. It's just the drop off from those down to, you know, kind of like exchangeable, essentially goaltenders is severe, or like there's only a few of those. And yes. So, you know, there's a large collection of exchangeable goaltenders out there.
Shane's saying it doesn't really make any difference, so you might as well go with the hot guy. Mm-hmm. Here's another story. Well, one, we could ask empirically, because that's the situation that happens. That's not a hypothetical. That situation happens. And I think Shane's answer probably fits with the way most NHL coaches manage it, with that very important caveat that if you've got a big difference, then you go back with the starter. But here's a question for you guys. You know, it's such a thing, historically, hockey goalie hotness in the playoffs. It's in people's psyche. It's got to be in the player's psyche. I wonder if you could show that the rest of the team in front of the goalie, plays differently with a guy that's on one of these streaks. Surely, given all the statistics that we have now and the tracking information that we have now, we could at least ask the question. Do the five guys in front of the goalie play any differently when they're playing in front of a guy who's on one of those playoff streaks?
Yeah, no, and I mean, I think you'd have to kind of, I would be intrigued. I mean, I've been kind of, that would be like one kind of direction of a larger thing, like how people's, the on ice sort of like, you know, tenacity of the puck and all these things, how that changes in playoff hockey versus regular season hockey. I already feel like I haven't seen that. I'd love to kind of still see that type of analysis, but I think I agree that if we can get down to that level of analysis, then why not also look at, you know, if you're in front of like, you know, a hot goaltender, you know, or if you're in front of a struggling goaltender, are you more timid? Like, do you play more conservatively? Like, how, like, are there kind of like larger kind of team level sort of things that have dynamics that can kind of happen in those scenarios?
Mike, I think we better let you go. We'll look forward to future conversations with you. And we very much appreciate your making time for us. That was Micah Blake McCurdy. He is a hockey analyst. He is a mathematician who's deploying his skills to better understand hockey, explain hockey, visualize hockey for us. He's a terrific follow at Ineffective Math on Twitter. For the whole crew here, Shane Jensen, Audie Weiner, this has been Cade Massey. For Eric Bradlow in absentia, for Maddie Batts, the boss man, for Mr. Dion Simpkins, the associate boss man. Appreciate y'all listening. Come back and join us next time. Between now and then, enjoy your sports.